Welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you every weekday from 9 until 1 on Share Radio, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online, are back in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Editor Simon Lambert joined by Lee Boyce and Adrian Lowry here today. And the crisis in Greece once again dominating the news agenda, with the country seemingly on the brink of an exit from the Eurozone, with days to go before Athens must make a crucial debt repayment to the International Monetary Fund. What next for the Greek tragedy? The RBS Group has had to apologise this week after another computer glitch delayed around 600,000 payments for customers. RBS say all accounts have now been updated, but is this creaking city tech good enough in a digital age? Also coming up today, buy-to-let, a business or an investment? Could landlords be about to lose one of Britain's best tax breaks? Could this be the start of a diesel tax? While the government is under pressure to act, half of new cars being sold are diesels, but would you consider swapping to electric? The best age to get financial advice? Well, I'm afraid you're probably past it. And we'll also be discussing the phenomenon of premiumisation. What is it? Well, you're probably already doing it. Stay tuned, we'll let you know. Also, an investigation's been launched into fake reviews being used by companies online. The Competition and Markets Authority is concerned that firms are also cherry-picking the best comments and paying for positive feedback. So we're asking today, what was the last thing you bought based on an online review? And what was your experience of it? A very warm welcome, Simon, Adrian, Lee, to the studio. Simon, starting with you, please, the last thing you bought based on an online review and your experience of it.
I am unsure of the last thing I bought, according to an online review, but I think that it might be something very sort of bloke-ish. Which is basically, I think I bought some mini clamps, some little clamps, in order to clamp something onto something while I was sticking it on. And the reviews of them were very good and said that they did exactly what you needed. Basically, there's a panel that's fallen off the back of my car and it needs reattaching to the car, and something needs to hold it in place whilst it's being attached. Right. And these mini clamps are the ideal thing. And I've possibly just put myself into boring corner here, haven't I?
Yeah. Well, I'm just hoping you didn't write a review about it, because the clamps that go on the bit at the back of the... What on earth are you talking about there, Simon?
But, I think online reviews are really good, and I do trust them. I do use them. I use them for things like, especially when you go into stay places, the TripAdvisor ones, or, you know, like B&Bs and stuff like that. And I think that they are really good, and I think you can tell the dodgy ones.
But I imagine to you this, the Competition Markets Authority comes as no really big surprise.
No, it doesn't. I understand that they have been looking at the mini clamp review situation for a while.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So underwhelmed, you can't even remember what the review was. Adrian, a very warm welcome to you. Before I ask you, this is your first time.
Yes,
so what do you do at This Is Money?
I am assistant editor. I run the website when Simon's here doing Share Radio. And, yeah, I spend quite a lot of time editing the homepage, and, you know, making sure there's lots of new stories going up.
So now I know what you do. I want to know, last thing you bought on an online review.
Well, it was almost certainly some cycling gear, because there's a steady stream of that that arrives at the office in various sizes of parcels. And, yes, the internet is pretty invaluable for finding out about that sort of thing. There's a few places that I go to. There are cycling forums where you can ask other keen cyclists about, you know, is this bit of kit any good? You can also read online reviews from the cycling magazines and things like that. And then occasionally some of the actual shop websites have star reviews, like they have on Amazon.
So fair to say, positive experience?
Yeah, I think so, because you make an assessment based on various sources, actual written reviews, you know.
But I'm thinking Simon, cars and clamps, you and cycling. Lee, handbags, maybe shoes.
Oh, always, Georgie. Yeah? Always, boy. I have to make sure that the quality of stitching in my handbag is going to be all right. something like books, always go on Amazon, read reviews. You can tell the ones that look a bit rubbish compared to the others. And the same with Simon, TripAdvisor. Always look at, if I'm going away a certain area, do that ranking thing where you see what's number one rated. And this, you know, some TripAdvisor have hundreds and hundreds of reviews. the likelihood of all of those being fake is very, very slim. They have massive detection systems.
I find I migrate to the ones with the most reviews, but then that's bad for the small businesses, though, isn't it?
Well, it's hard if you're starting out now, because you've got to start from scratch, haven't you? I guess
one bad review could be 50%
of the reviews. But they have like an algorithm where it doesn't get lost just because you haven't got many. I think sometimes it is a bit about quality rather than quantity.
Say you've got, like, you're starting out, you get you get really good to your first 10 customers, you get those 10 customers to go leave a review for you, then all of a sudden you've got 10 reviews on there and people like Lee are going, I like what you're doing.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio on Digital Online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Editor Simon Lambert, Adrian Lowry and Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online, join me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. And if you have any questions you want to put to the team, do get in contact with them. And they can investigate it and come back to the studio next week and tell us what they found out. But coming up, the Greek crisis once again dominates, with the country seemingly on the brink of an exit from the Eurozone. Just days to go before Athens must make a crucial debt repayment to the International Monetary Fund, Greece's Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis says he's confident of a solution.
We are dangerously close to a state of mind that accepts an accident. And I urge my colleagues not to fall prey to this state of mind. We can forge a good agreement.
But news reports suggest banks might face closure as panic savers withdraw 2 billion euros in deposits in the past few days. Well, the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, says the Greek government needs to make some realistic suggestions.
It cannot be about smoke and mirror. It has to be tangible proposals. We are waiting and we hope that the next few days will be used by the Greek authorities to come back with deliverable measures.
Well, Eurozone countries have been preparing for a Grexit, including, of course, here in the UK. Chancellor George Osborne was speaking at an EU meeting of finance ministers in Luxembourg.
We hope for the best, but we now must be prepared for the worst. And in the United Kingdom, we've taken the measures to increase our economic security so we can deal with risks like this from abroad. And clearly now we must go on and complete that plan.
Right, so Adrian, the task falls to you first. I want it in 2 minutes, please. Where are we at and why are we here?
Well, it really is reaching crisis point, finally, I think. I think the payments that are due from Greece in the next few weeks will see an end game. The Greek Prime Minister warned if Greece was forced out, that would be the end of the euro. So he's upping the stakes there because that's the, you know, that's the crunch. That's why Germany has been bending over backwards to keep them in there, because of that fear, because of the fear of contagion to other countries in the eurozone, etc. But the scale of the payments that Greece faces, especially going into July, there's one at the end of June, there are even bigger ones coming through July.
Because this is just 1.1 billion by the end of June, then you've got July payment and August payment. This is
peanuts in comparison
to what they owe.
Absolutely. So I think that the end of July might be the crunch point, and that might be when we see a resolution.
So we kick the can a bit further down the road until July. Mm.
However, you know, how serious that is, whether he's right that it will spell the end of the euro, that is obviously a fairly cataclysmic sort of prediction. Whether he's correct about that is more dubious.
Clearly, savers are worried. 2 billion euros of deposits have already been taken out of the country in the first 3 days of this week alone. Tourists heading to Greece being warned to take cash in case of emergencies. Simon?
Well, I mean, Greece has been suffering this sort of slow-motion bank run for years now. I mean, it's really, if you look at it, it's surprising there's any money left in Greek banks. I mean, who would keep money in the Greek banks? A reader actually flagged something this week on Twitter that I'd written, and it was a blog going back a few years now, which was how to identify where a euro note is from, because this currency company had put out this press release saying that basically, you know, euro notes, they have a little letter on them that shows what country they're from, and maybe those Greek ones might not be worth so much. And the opening line of this blog said, with speculation hitting fever pitch that Greece is about to be bundled out of the euro, the date on that, May 2012. Well, it's it's June 2015 now, isn't it? So we're 3 years down the line,
yeah.
And it's still going on. And it has been this kicking the can down the road. And I think that the real problem here is that basically what's going on in Greece is really bad already. I mean, there's some statistics here. So basically there's been a 25% drop in gross domestic product, 28% reduction in public sector employment, 28.5% drop in food consumption.
Wow.
The average pension is down 61%. They're 45% of pensioners are living below the poverty line, and there's 26% unemployment and 50% amongst the under 25s. That's really, really, really bad for any country.
No one is in any doubt. They cannot repay. Yeah, they will not repay.
The big problem is that basically all of this, they need this money desperately, this last slice of bailout money, in order to repay loans. Interest on loans from the IMF and their creditors, and the IMF are part of the problem. I think that Greece should be forgiven some of the debt.
Yes. And also, the huge sticking point, there might actually be some agreement over the debt emerging. The real sticking point is over these pension benefits.
Mm.
So it's like a cultural change that the IMF are trying to force onto Greece. And here I have some sympathy with Greece because the elderly people in that country at the moment are propping up their families with these pensions, you know, and they've been funded privately in many cases for the IMF or the Troika, three huge groups of creditors, to try to force them to cut the incomes of one of the few sectors of society that are actually holding families together and kind of providing income is really unfair. And if they would just move on that, then maybe some sort of agreement might be. So I think, you know, kind of Greece gets a little bit of a bad press sometimes for being this kind of basket case, but I don't blame Syriza, the leading party, for standing firm on that.
We're also hearing, indeed, that Russia saying it'll consider bailing out Greece, which will get the US rather interested in all this. Lee, your views on that?
Worrying sign, if I'm being honest with you. But, you know, Greece is desperate. It needs some sort of solution to the problem. And if, you know, they're getting forced their hand to pay this amount of money. Someone says there needs to be some sort of arrangement needs to come off. Some of the debt needs to be written off because I just can't see how they're going to get out of it. But the trouble is, the Euro is not really a level playing field. It should have had probably like a two-tier system or something because the economy of Germany and the economy of Greece, Cyprus, these sort of countries are just not on par. So it's trudged along. And as Simon says, this has been going on for ages now, Greece. It's been almost like slow motion. So it's like, what next? I don't know.
That's quite right. And when the Euro was formed, there was a huge debate among economists about whether to converge first or whether to have the single currency first. And one theory went that you let the economies get more similar under the European Union as like a trading bloc. And then once they become more converged and more connected, then you have a single currency. That didn't win out. What won out would let's slap a single currency on top of these massively different economies and that will help them to converge. And obviously it hasn't done.
Over the years, in the boom times, before the Eurozone crisis, you know, emerged, eight years ago, when everything was going well and Greece was living beyond its means, basically. This is the fundamental problem. The Germans and the Northern Europeans don't want to bail out the Southern Europeans who spent many years living beyond their means. But the Northern Europeans were busy selling stuff to those Southern Europeans and profiting from it. You know, there is this apocryphal sort of stat that apparently at one point Athens was the Porsche Cayenne capital of Europe. There were more Porsche Cayennes relative to the population in that city than in any other city in Europe. And someone was selling those Porsches to the Greeks. And unfortunately, if you want to have a currency union, you have to have this situation where you are willing to transfer, you know, funds from one part to the other in the same way that in the UK, there are parts of the UK that help to support other parts of the UK. I don't know how long you'd have to wait until the Greek and the German economy were similar, but I'm guessing it would be a very, very long time.
Simon, it seems a bit selfish of me to suggest this, considering the stats you've just read out a little bit earlier. But of course, every country in the Eurozone will now be thinking about what will happen should a Grexit occur. But what will the impact be on us here, the pound in our pocket?
Well, I think that we probably think that we're relatively insulated from this. And we think, oh, well, we'll be all right. You know, we're not in the Euro. But the Eurozone is our major trading partner. It's almost certain that Greece would not manage to exit the Euro without some form of next wave of financial crisis occurring. A lot of the European banks are now much better insulated from Greece than they were, say, 3 years ago. So 3 years ago, this would have been a massive problem. But, you know what? I don't think in practice that you would actually see that thing. There's this talk of like a Lehman Brothers moment, as happened in the financial crisis. And these things always happen over a weekend as well. It's worth bearing that in mind. A country will be bundled out of a currency union over the weekend. The banks will shut. You know, they'll shut on a Friday. They won't be open all weekend. And on the Monday, they'll be out. So the question is, this weekend, next weekend, next weekend.
Stick your bets on the last weekend in July.
Yeah, stick your bets on the last weekend in July. There's a lot of people. There was a suggestion this morning that it might be this week. This might be a Lehman weekend. So we ran a poll on the site, actually, said, should Greece leave the euro? And 90% of people said yes, basically. And I think a lot of those people are thinking, well, I think that they should leave the euro and it probably won't affect us. Now, my personal view is that Greece would be better off out of the euro anyway, but I think it would be better off out of the euro with some form of managed exit and change to the way the euro works rather than being bundled out over a weekend and shutting the doors and then opening them again to the new drachma, because that could lead to it could lead to Greece becoming a failed state, essentially.
OK, yeah. I want one-word answers as you pose the question. Greece in or out? Better off in, better off out?
Overall, out.
Yeah, it's better off out, probably.
Out.
There we go. Let us know. 66777. Text must start with the word share. You're listening to Consuming Issues.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Welcome. If you've just joined us, we were talking there about the possibility of a Grexit. Editor Simon Lambert, Adrian Lowry, and Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online, are live with me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Let's turn our attention to the Royal Bank of Scotland apologising again, as 600,000 delayed payments have now been processed after a technical fault, a computer glitch. It has been a one of a number to have hit the bank, and the fault left thousands waiting for payments like wages and benefits.
The actual problem, the technical problem that happened, that's now been fixed, so the flow of payments is now flowing normally. There is high demand, and so there has been a number of people phoning, and so therefore there has been some pressure on the phones. We've brought everyone that's able to deal on, so we've increased the numbers materially to be able to cope with the flow and demand from customers. But primarily, you know, the first thing and the most important thing I have to say is we're really sorry. We know it's not acceptable.
Well, that was Stuart Hare from RBS there. So, Lee, let's come to you first. Then your overall reaction to this latest technical fault from RBS. Just remind us what happened.
So, on Wednesday, 600,000 transactions didn't process. So that meant things like wages didn't get paid in. Luckily, it's not this really time in the month where a lot of wages get paid in anyway, because people tend to get paid at the end of the month or the start of the month. So it would have been a much bigger problem if it had been at the end of the start of the month. So it's worth pointing that out. But wages didn't go out and bills weren't paid. So it could cause a real problem for people. But as RBS say, no one should be left out of pocket with this. It's not as bad as the meltdown it had in 2012. I don't know if you remember that one, but that was massive.
Reminders of that one.
Well, that went on for almost a month in some situations, in some cases. Again, it was something very similar. There was a sort of system update and it just managed to lose people's accounts and all sorts of bad things happened. And it just begs the question, if the technology that RBS and NatWest has, if it's keeping up with the times and it's keeping up with the demand. Because the chief exec has boasted in the past that, you know, the busiest branch now is the 7 a.m. Paddington train, because people are, you know, using apps, they're using online. You know, are these systems buckling under all of this pressure? It's a lot of strain. And some of these legacy systems, they would have built these decades ago. So they're just layering on top and layering on top. And this is where, you know, Challenger Bank's a new entrance with a clean slate have got more of a chance of, you know, not suffering from these kind of meltdowns.
Well, after that problem, it was a software upgrade in June 2012. Millions of customers unable to access their bank accounts on that particular occasion. The IT failure affected more than 6.5 million customers, you say here, over several weeks. And now they invested then hundreds of million pounds to improve its computer systems on top of billions already spent. But RBS are not alone in this. The city's creaking system. Some of these go back 70s, 80s.
If you're a business or a bank that's been running for a long time and you're running on the same system, then it's quite likely that that's going to hark back to the old-fashioned black screen with a flashing green cursor. I mean, I'm not joking here. You know, there are major companies out there. Some of Britain's biggest companies' payroll is still running off that kind of stuff. Also, you have the issue where basically the people who know how to fix that stuff, they're few and far between because they've become such niche systems. And you've now got, as Lee said, you've got the age of modern-day digital banking interacting with that. Not only is it interacting with that and having to do the payments, but apparently because of mobile banking, digital banking, there are a lot more payments going through because it's much easier to just send someone some money quickly. And in fact, banks are actively promoting this through things like the PayM service where you pay someone through your mobile and stuff. So there's lots more of these small transactions going through. People pay for more stuff on a card and things like that. And it just adds a lot of extra weight to these systems. And RBS, when they had the last big crash, you know, it was said they did not invest enough money in their systems under the sort of the Fred the Shred years and the boom years, and they're now paying the price for that. But there are, you know, there are other major banks and they're investing lots of money into this stuff, but it's very difficult for them, you know.
Spending it on the fines, aren't they? Adrian, it's just another thing, isn't it, about banks and losing faith with us.
Well, I've got to say, if I was an RBS customer, I'd have switched a long time ago. It is a lot easier now to switch your current account. There are rules in place that have forced banks to make it easy for you. The bank that you move to should manage the process for you. They can take a look at your old account, see all the direct debit standing orders that you've got going out and just transfer those across. And if you're unhappy, some people might be happy staying with RBS, but if you're unhappy, it really is worth just, you know, biting the bullet. And there are lots of other really good bank accounts out there with Santander and Nationwide and First Direct. Pay interest, they have really good online banking, you know, they don't tend to fall over.
Yeah.
So
Lee, loads of information on This Is Money about that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, I'd written a blog this week because I've moved from NatWest. Finally.
Yes, you did.
Finally moved, yeah, because there was these sort of, it wasn't the first time even this year that there's been a problem with RBS. Earlier in March, you know, they had something similar. It wasn't as a large scale as this, but it shows in latest switching stats that it is one of the biggest losers of switchers. So more people are switching out than are switching into NatWest than RBS. And I just don't feel like they wanted to keep me as a customer in the last couple of years. They haven't done enough to convince me to stay with them.
Like what? What would you expect bank to do?
They moved me onto this paid-for bank account, which I wouldn't do, but it came with like a Love Film account, for example, which I already had anyway. So it kind of made sense for me just to move across. But then they hiked up the cost. They've got rid of certain perks, including Love Film. And I just overdraft charges changed. I started paying more on my overdraft. And what I did actually, there's this new service called My Data, which is government backed. Basically, on your online banking, you can click a button and it takes your year's worth of statements and then it will crunch it and it will tell you which bank account you'd be best off with. So the top one I had was First Direct. So I know that it's got good customer service. We've written about it loads. And I did the 7-day switch and it's gone through as smoothly as you could possibly imagine. All my direct debits, my wages have gone in as normal. This is that panic. I think that's what people panic that, my wages won't get paid in or something bad's going to happen. These new 7-day switching rules really have made a big difference. And yeah, you should definitely have a look on This Is Money website at our 5 best current accounts. We've got the lowdown.
Well, save your voice, Lee, because you know what's coming up next. We turn our attention to cars.
Morning Money. The markets, the papers, and the city. Today's Need to Know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's Need to Know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
This is Consuming Issues here on Share Radio, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm Georgie Frost. Now, Lee, as we promised then, turning our attention to cars and coming up why electric cars are being snapped up at bargain prices. But first, as petrol prices have accelerated, they've reached a six-month high, an average of 117 pence per litre. Diesel also nudging up over 121 pence for the first time this year. Now, this is according to the latest stats from AA. But are we now about to see the rise of a diesel tax as well on top of all this? Definitely one for you, Simon, focuses on your favourite council. But before we do bemoan Islington, why are we seeing a rise in petrol prices despite, I thought, oil was staying fairly stable at the moment, Lee?
Yeah, well, that's the big question, isn't it, Georgia? I mean, you know, oil really did dip earlier in the year. Mm. So we had the cheapest petrol we'd had for a long time at the start of February because oil had gone down to $45 a barrel, Brent crude. It's slowly risen since. It sort of went up into April, start of April, but it's levelled off a bit and it's sort of gone down a little bit as well. So you're wondering, you know, well, why is that not reflecting at the pumps? But sometimes there's a bit of a delay. So it might be, you know, where they've bought a couple of months ago, so they're filtering that through. But it's one of those sort of industries, it's so difficult to tell you who's making these decisions, who's like hiking up the costs. And the AA research this morning, it still shows that it pays to go to a supermarket, for example, with Asda, you know, it's far cheaper than anywhere else. So how is it that they're offering it at a more reasonable price than the bigger retailers?
Well, as I promised there, diesel cars, hot topic of the moment, as you say, Lee, just take a look on This Is Money website. But your council, Simon, Islington, I believe. Oh, yes. Charging thousands of diesel cars. Brace yourself for this, everybody. Charging thousands of diesel drivers an extra £96 permit fee just for parking outside their homes in a move that's made the council £1 million a year. I don't know why I'm explaining this, Simon. The floor is yours.
Yes, my name is Simon Lambert. I live in Islington and I have a diesel car and I'm a bad person.
Yes, you are.
So we talked about this before, actually. So regular listeners will know that this is not my favourite thing. But Islington Council has taken it upon itself, and it's really the first one to do this to such an extent, to charge owners of diesel cars through their parking permit more money because it wants to discourage diesel cars because it says they are bad for people's health. So it's an extra £96 a year on top of your parking permit, for which for me, I think our parking permit is about £120. They go, some of them are £400-odd. It's graded on emissions. So every diesel car pays this. And now the reason behind this, OK, so it's important to realise what the reason behind this is that for many years, people have been encouraged to buy diesels through the road tax system and actually in Islington through the parking permit system, which favours them because they produce lower levels of CO2, so they were judged to be less polluting. And that has led to a situation where now half of all new cars sold, and this has been the case for a while, are diesels. But what's emerged and has got a lot of extra publicity over the last year or so is that diesels produce a higher level of nitrogen oxide, which is considered to be bad for your health. And there's been campaigners of saying something had to be done. The government actually does have to do something about this to meet some sort of emissions, clean air emissions targets. But Islington has decided that it's therefore going to discourage people from owning a diesel car and charge them £96 a year extra, which is wrong for a number of reasons.
You believe so far they are alone at this?
Yes, they're the first council to do this. Now, the reason why I say this is wrong for a number of reasons is, firstly, I'm not some crazy flat earther who's denying all the science here. If diesels are actually genuinely causing problems to people's health, then we do need to do something about it. The evidence that's been put forward by Islington Council is not very good, I should add. But there is evidence out there that says this. But it's not the council's job to do that. It's the government's job to do that. The council also owes its residents an apology because it has spent the last number of years encouraging them to buy diesel cars through its CO2 emission graded parking permits. And it hasn't offered that apology to people. Also, this is deeply regressive because basically, if you have more money, you are more likely to be able to go, right, I'm not going to have a diesel car anymore, I'm going to go buy a petrol one. You're more likely to be able to go buy a new car. If you don't have much money, you're not going to be able to go buy a new car. £96 is a larger chunk of a person's lower wages than it is of a person's higher wages. It doesn't reflect in any way actually how much nitrogen oxide the cars produce. And in fact, even if you have a plug-in hybrid vehicle that's diesel, you'll get hit by this anyway. And also my final point is that the richer you are, the more likely you are to have a drive, a house with a drive, and therefore you wouldn't need to pay for a parking permit so you could avoid the tax.
There's not many driveways in Islington.
There's not many, but there are some. There's some on my road. And it tends to be the owned people who own the houses who have them. And the final thing is it doesn't do anything about all the cars that drive in and out the borough every day that aren't owned by its residents.
And breathe. On this note, though, it also, if you take a look at an article you've written, Lee Boyce, I want a 7-seater car. Well, I don't. But this is what someone's written to you asking a query. But yes. I'm wary of buying a diesel as they seem to be coming in for more punishment. What petrol options are there? Now, this is a chap I've assumed here. I don't know. It could be either. Mm-hmm. I want to buy a nearly new car and I need to have 7 seats. But I've discovered almost all of the MPVs or SUV style cars that I look at are diesel.
Yeah, well, car manufacturers have been massively incentivised to push more diesels out there because of the reasons that Simon just mentioned, because we were told that actually they're not as bad for the environment, CO2's, greenhouse emissions and all of that stuff. So, a lot of cars are diesels now. And something like a big car like the 7-seater that's been asked for by a lady reader, a lot of them are diesel. And diesels are really only beneficial if you're doing long journeys every year, if you're doing over 12,000 miles, for instance. The likelihood is this is going to be a sort of school run around. So I would presume, probably a city-type environment. So, but people are struggling to find petrol models of sort of nearly new cars, as to speak, because a lot of them are diesel.
All right, well, give us some that you did find, then, that lady reader can purchase.
Well, we asked What Car, who are, you know, car specialists, and they recommended the Ford S-Max, pretty decent car, and another one's a Volvo XC90, both around about £13,000, with 30,000 miles on the clock, but you're getting a lot of car for your money.
Is that good for someone who doesn't know about cars?
Yeah,
and
for a big seven-seater car, you know, that's 2 years old, I mean, it's not bad at all. I mean, probably brand new, you're talking treble that almost.
Wow.
So, you know, and a lot of people like to buy their cars nearly new rather than brand new because, of course, if you buy a brand new car, as soon as you drive it off the forecourt, you've lost a massive chunk of money. So people like to buy nearly new cars. And, you know, in this situation, I think she's quite sensible because who knows what council that she's in. There might be some sort of diesel parking, you know, tax that comes in. You just don't know. The government's now under pressure to, you know, remove the number of diesel cars in the country. It's got to do something. We just don't know what yet.
I mean, I think Simon is quite right on a couple of points there, that it's unfair for a council to pick on diesel car owners, and also that it's not really the council's place to sort of make this sort of green policy. However, it's a not very widely reported economic fact that the cost of cars and driving is not fully borne by the people who own cars. When you factor in all the costs of congestion and noise pollution, the environmental impact, the effect it has on people's lives in cities, makes them in many ways quite unpleasant places to live. All those costs are not borne by the driver. They're borne by the wider society. If those costs were factored in to things like petrol and cars, everything will be a lot more expensive. So I don't have much sympathy with you know, the constant cries from drivers that, well, this is becoming more expensive and we're having to pay this tax and more for petrol. I think that cars are a drug, or rather, you know, motorised vehicles that use fuel like petrol and diesel are a drug that we have to wean ourselves off in the end.
You're a big cyclist, aren't you?
Well, yeah, yeah. I know at the moment it's, you know, it's probably quite unfair to say that because lots of people really do depend on their cars. But yeah, I think looking forward 50 years, we might well look back on the current sort of situation and think that it was slightly crazy.
The answer is an electric car.
The answer, therefore, exactly. And on your website, the green cars that you can get a £5,000 grant for, sales rocket fivefold as drivers scoop up subsidy. How long will the pot last? Adrian, your view then on green cars, electric cars?
Yeah, well, it seems to me like a good idea. I like the fact that they're not as noisy. I also think that idea is driverless cars, which is another development that's in the pipeline, because lots of the poor behaviour you see on roads is driver-based, shall we say. And I think, you know, if we had lots of nice, quiet, well-driven driverless cars moving smoothly around our streets, ooh, it would improve urban life.
Adrian, I can hear the people shouting
It would improve urban life immeasurably. You might be able to sit outside the pub or the cafe and not have to breathe in fumes. You might be able to hear yourself speak in the street.
that lack of noise, though, actually, funnily enough, with these green cars, with these eco cars, which are selling, they're not... You could say they're selling like hotcakes at the moment, but actually what's happened is there was a very small number of them being sold, and now there's still a small number of them being sold, but compared to the small number, it's quite a lot bigger. And you get this 5K grant, but it probably will run out in maybe a year or two, I think, and it could run out sooner than people think. But one of these things with these green cars is they don't make a noise. They make a little whizzing noise. And some friends of ours looked at buying one of these, and they said that actually that was one of the things they found disconcerting. So you can actually pay for an option where it makes a noise, like a car. The electric car has a, you know, recording of a car making a noise. So when you accelerate, it makes a noise. The other thing they said, and it's interesting what they were looking at here, because they were looking at this BMW i3. Now, what's happened with these electric cars as well, that's quite interesting, is that there's a lot more of them available and they've got a lot more attractive. So it used to be, you know, you got yourself a Prius or something, or some other, like there was a Vauxhall Ampera and there was another one, a Nissan Leaf, but there wasn't a huge amount of choice. Now you can get yourself, you know, a BMW i3, which is like a sort of, it's like a hatchback style car, but it's as big as a small saloon. You can get yourself a supercar, a BMW i8. You can get yourself an Audi A3. You can get yourself a Porsche. You can get yourself a couple of Renaults, a Tesla, which have been really popular. Loads of Volkswagens, Volvos and so on. So they're really appealing to people, and the friends of ours, you know, thought, yeah, well, we need a new car, look at this. The other thing that was said was that basically, it was my wife's friend, it made her feel seasick, basically, the acceleration of it. Because basically, there's not the same feeling of acceleration as there is in a petrol or diesel car, where there's a slight sort of lag. All the power just goes straight to the wheels. It's like a really fast golf buggy, and it was sort of moving backwards and forwards like that, and made her feel seasick.
Advancing so quickly, isn't it, Lee? But let's just return back, if you wouldn't mind, to the £5,000 government grant. Mm. What's this about?
So it's been going for quite a long time now, so you just get it off the purchase price of the car. Now, I put in a phone call to the Department for Transport last week and asked when this money would run out, because they promised an extra £200 million for these grants, but that only works out at 40,000 grants, you know, 40,000, 5,000 grants. The thing is, there was 10,000 cars in the first 3 months of 2015 sold. So you've got to expect that most of those would have used a £5,000 grant. So that's already a quarter of the pot. So since, you know, if the sales have gone up even more, the pot's going to have dwindled even further. So it's still out there. You can still get £5,000 off one of these cars. And I actually test drove one a couple of weeks ago.
And what was that like?
The Mitsubishi Outlander, which is the biggest selling plug-in hybrid. It was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, it was...
Seasick?
No, at all. No, it was a very smooth ride. And actually, it had technology.
The other one was a BMW. They're rubbish. That's why I made it feel seasick.
The technology, actually, so it's very, very quiet. But when it's in a city, it kicks in, so it knows it's in a city. And it makes a little bit more noise for pedestrians crossing the road.
Or cyclists, I was going to say, Adrian.
Or
cyclists.
Or annoying Adrian when he's sitting outside a cafe.
It is true, actually. Yeah, you don't hear them coming, but they are quite nice to ride behind. I quite like drafting cars, and they're quite nice to ride behind because you don't get a mouthful of exhaust fumes.
Yeah.
Does want to get a green car?
I actually really, really liked it. And I've noticed down my road, there is a BMW i3 down there that someone's got. And I see... It's just a 3-point plug pin, so you plug it in at home, but they've got like an extension lead on an extension lead coming out of the window, and that's the biggest sticking point in London. If you want one of these cars and you live in a flat or you live in somewhere that hasn't got a driveway and you haven't got a charging point nearby, it's quite impractical.
The other thing that stops people from buying them is the range. So basically, the range is limited. Even on the ones that have the biggest range, it's probably about 200 miles. I think most of them, the biggest range is about 100 miles or slightly over that. So if you were going to try and do a really long journey, so we drive up to my wife's dad's up in Shropshire, that's 170 miles, I think, you would struggle to do that in one go. So you'd have to stop partway and charge it. And they do have a fast charge on them where you can do it quite quickly, but you've still got to sit at the service station and wait. Maybe we just need to like adapt our behaviour and realise that we can't just rush everywhere, but those batteries are changing.
Factor it into the trip.
That range is getting longer and longer, and those batteries are changing, and there's a lot of stuff going on to do with batteries and holding on to power at the moment that's really interesting, especially coming out of America with this company Tesla. And probably over the next 5-10 years you could see a big change. But that makes me think, why would I buy an electric car now, where the range might be limited to 100 miles? If I wait 3 years, I might get one that could do 300 or 400 miles.
It could be like looking back, those giant mobile phones. Yeah. Yeah. Really expensive at the start, and now look at
us. But you could argue that with everything.
Everything, you could. I was going to say, the one thing I'd say about the range is that we took the Mitsubishi down to Bournemouth from London, so it's 32 mile purely on electric. But then what happens is, when it runs out, it kicks into petrol, you press a button, and it recharges the battery as you drive along with kinetic energy. Mm. So then after another burst of driving a petrol, you can flip back to the battery. So it kind of, you know, you can't run solely from here to Bournemouth on electric, but you could do at least half the journey in it.
Scientists, hey, what will they think of next?
The voice you're hearing, Lee Boyce, also the studio editor, Simon Lambert, Adrian Lauer. And this is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online. Coming up, the best age to get financial advice. Well, no offence, lads, just looking around here, I think we're all a little bit past that one.
Hi, I'm Ed Bauscher, Share Radio's senior analyst and personal finance expert. My job is to explain the big financial issues in a simple, easy-to-understand way, and I do that across a range of different Share Radio shows. In the mornings, I chat with Georgie Frost about things like bank accounts, insurance, and sometimes the euro. And in the evenings, I talk about what's happened on the stock market in the Market Wrap with Simon Rose.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio. Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket
go that little bit further.
Welcome back. Now, this might come as a bit of a worry to most people, but apparently the best time to get financial advice for retirement is 25. Oh dear, never mind. That's according to unbiased.co.uk, who say most people end up leaving getting financial advice, well, 10 years too late, some a little bit longer than that. They found that adults tend to save £97 a month, which over the course of 30 years works out to, well, just over 25 grand for retirement. Unbiased and MetLife, who carried out this research, say that by starting earlier and saving better, it could benefit younger people. What about the rest of us? Lee, you're closest to that age range, 25. You're still a bit past it, but have you ever got any financial advice?
No.
Well, you don't need to. You give it out.
I think the biggest problem with, you know, someone at 25 is that they're not looking at the bigger picture. You know, very few people at 25 are thinking to themselves, you know, have I got a pension that's going to see me when we retire, which is probably going to be about 80 the way things are going. But, you know, more looking at the shorter term. How am I going to buy a house? How am I going to finance a car? Mm. People will tend to look at their pensions if they are enrolled and that sort of stuff and see how it's doing. But I think looking at a longer game like this, I don't think people 25 or under are going to seek financial advice. You know, they're first starting out their careers, you know, might finish uni at 21, 22, screwing it away a bit of money in a savings account, getting into that habit. But, you know, it's more about house ownership and when rents and prices are going up, and that's at the forefront of news all the time. That's the focus.
But also, Simon, finance advice costs money.
It does. I seriously doubt that there's any 25-year-olds out there, unless there's something maybe in very high-paying jobs or working in the city, paying for financial advice. I mean, you're looking at probably £150 an hour is the general cost that's quoted. You know, when you look at the cost quoted for, say, sorting out someone's pension at the other end of life, it's normally they quote £1,500 minimum. It's a big chunk of money to someone who's 25. But, I mean, I've spoken about this before and I've said that, you know, there is a massive benefit to starting saving or investing earlier in your life. And this is what's being reflected in this report. And there's this wonderful trick where basically the difference between saving £100 a month for 30 years and 40 years, or investing, actually, I should say, between 30 years and 40 years, is you double your money. So if you did it for 30 years, so say from the age of 35 to 65, you invested £100 a month and you managed to get a 6% return, which is not unreasonable, you would end up with just over £100,000. Do it for 40 years, so start doing it at 25, and you'll end up with £200,000. Mm. So that's worth doing. But you don't need financial advice to do that. You can do that yourself. So I would say that if you're 25 years old, maybe it might be worth getting financial advice if you've got a particularly complicated scenario, but just start paying some money into your pension. Maybe it's your work pension, your employer will contribute to it, or start paying £100 a month into a simple, low-cost tracker fund investment. And over that next, you know, 40 years, you should be able to get that 6% return if you're reinvesting the dividends and you get that compound interest. And then you'll have 200 grand.
It's about mindset, isn't it? It's about encouraging us to save. And I guess, Adrian, auto-enrolment might help as well in that.
Yes, I think there was a psychological study once found that, you know, people actually just don't think more than 8 years ahead. It's hard for them to envisage themselves in more than 8 years' time. And that's behind a lot of the reason why people just don't think about pensions in their 20s, 30s, even 40s. And it is about mindset. It's about almost training yourself to think about these things seriously, because, you know, when you're 25, you don't want to think about being 65 or 70. It's often your property that's the most important thing. With stock market crashes that affected pension funds, that put a lot of people off saving into a pension. People thought the property's safer. And so if you have any spare money, which in many people's cases, you know, kind of unlikely, then, you know, it's more often the case that they're going to put it into property, that they're going to, you know, use it to pay the rent or buy a house. So.
Well, talking about property, we'll stick with the theme of property, but bad news potentially for buy-to-let landlords, as they could be set to lose one of Britain's best tax breaks. Now, the ability to offset mortgage interest against taxable rental income has long been a very alluring element of buy-to-let campaigners, though not so happy with it. Is it a business? Is it an investment? Simon, firstly, just tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, if you think about it, this is quite a good tax break, and I'll explain how it works. Basically, say you're renting out a property for £1,000 a month, and the mortgage cost on that is £500 a month, your interest-only mortgage, because most buy-to-let mortgages are interest-only. Well, you pay income tax on the rentable income that you get from that property, but you're allowed to take off your mortgage interest costs first before you decide the amount. So as most property investors, buy-to-let landlords, are going to be paying 40% tax because they'll tend to be wealthier, if it was taxed on the whole £1,000, they'd face a £400 a month tax bill. Because it's taxed on only the £500 once you've taken the mortgage interest off, it's only a £200 a month tax bill. And that boosts the returns. That's a really good boost to the returns. And then you're also allowed to offset various other things, such as maintenance, some wear and tear, letting agents' fees. You can even offset your mortgage arrangement fee. And the suggestion is that this is unfair. This is not a level playing field, because if you are a homeowner, you don't get to offset your mortgage interest against your tax bill. If you're a first-time buyer struggling to get onto the property ladder, and you've got some, you're going up against a buy-to-let landlord to buy that property, the suggestion is that they are getting a much greater benefit from you than you, and that they are more able to buy that property. They've got greater firepower in terms of purchasing power, and they get a favour in terms of how they can set up that financial arrangement. So it costs the, or it's worth, the last figures that I could find were £6 billion a year. George Osborne has to find some money from somewhere. He's painted himself into a bit of a corner with all the promises he dished out in the run-up to the election. And there is a suggestion that this could be hit. Now, but the reason why this exists is because basically buy-to-let is treated as a business, and the principle is that you only pay tax on your profit. And that cost of the mortgage is a business cost, and it is, does not represent your profit. So your profit is the gap between the mortgage and the rent. And I don't know whether they'll pull this one. I think that it could actually have quite serious unintended consequences for the property market.
You mentioned here many landlords, you say, only turn a small rental profit after costs, erode that by raising their tax bills, and they will surely raise rents. And we've been hearing today average rents across England and Wales jumping to a new record high of £778 a month.
But if you were a landlord and you were in this situation and you were barely making any money, of which, if you're a long-term landlord, you're probably sitting pretty because you bought your property for much less, very low mortgage on it. The monthly payments are going to be low. But, you know, there are people who have been investing over the years and they've been taking out 75% mortgages on these properties. And once they take into account all their costs, they're not really making much money. And if you suddenly removed this tax relief, they'd find themselves not making any money, potentially making a loss. And the reaction to that for many will be to put up the rent. So I would think that actually it could do a disservice to some of those first-time buyers and people saving. And we were having a conversation about this yesterday in the office. Ed Monk, our personal finance editor, made the point that if you were going to set up buy-to-let now, you wouldn't do this. You wouldn't allow this tax relief, because actually it's probably, for most people, they're not really running a business. But we have done that, and we are 20 years down the line, and we are now in this position. And probably just swiping it away isn't going to do you any favours. You do have to recognise the position that you're at rather than just the ideological position that you'd like to be in.
Finally, let's turn our attention, editor Simon Lambert, Adrian Lowry and Lee Boyce. This is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online 2. Have you ever heard of premiumisation? Well, you are probably already doing it. It's the phenomenon, apparently, of saving the pennies by, say, shopping at budget supermarkets and then splurging on something special from a luxury retailer. And it may be the reason, perhaps, that Aldi, Lidl have caused mayhem among mainstream supermarkets. But Waitrose and M&S Food, for example, well, they've stayed comparatively resilient. So, firstly, who's going to tell us about premiumisation? You're smiling at me, Adrian.
Well, I'm just smiling because I think I do the premium bit and I forget to do the economy bit at the other end. I've only got a Waitrose near me and
excuses.
Yeah.
How posh though. Have you got a Waitrose near you?
I think this is one. I mean, you know, I don't know. This was probably a survey or of some sort from a retail organisation. It's probably true if it lets people buy themselves a few more treats, and it's no bad thing.
Are the independents benefiting as well?
They are to some extent, yeah. I mean, you've seen, I think one of the beneficiaries, you know, since the recession, financial crisis era has been independent shops in a way, in that, you know, if you go to a high street that's doing well, you will find some good little independent shops there, and people are willing to spend the money on good stuff. And there is an effect that's been commented on by economists throughout the years that when money is tight, people will still continue to spend some money on quality things, and quality things will tend to do quite well, whereas middle of the market stuff does badly and cheap stuff does well as well. And I think that that's this effect that's happening, is people are going cheap because it's like, well, does it really matter what brand my washing up liquid is? Anybody who's ever washed any dishes knows that it doesn't really matter. I mean, Fairy's a little bit better, but it's not life-changingly better, is it? Whereas,
no.
Whereas what you're going to sit down and eat for dinner on a Friday night after a hard week at work does matter to you a lot. So you're going to go and spend a bit more on that food at Waitrose or M&S, and you're not going to care too much about your own brand washing liquid.
Is it us being savvy, or are we sort of duping ourselves a little bit? It's OK, because I've been to Lidl, I can go crazy in M&S. But in terms of budgeting, are we actually doing ourselves a disservice in the long run, potentially?
Not at all. My rule of thumb with this, so premiumisation, just in a nutshell, is people who will shop at Aldi and Lidl, you know, and buy sort of basic goods, such as, like, you know, washing up liquid and that sort of stuff, and then going to, like, independent retailers, butchers, et cetera, getting good cuts of meat. And I do this. I do this all the time. I buy all sorts of, like, budget, you know, stuff to clean the flat with, but stuff that's going inside me that I'm eating, it's got to be good quality. So you've got to treat yourself good and get the good stuff from the butchers and whatnot.
Well, there's nothing budget about you, Lee. Thank you very much. Lee Boyce, editor, Simon Lambert, Adrian Lowry from This Is Money. Thank you so much for joining us. Share Radio.